I would say read a lot and try to make informed decisions. If you're just starting out collecting, you will make some mistakes, but by educating yourself, by reading, people who know what they're talking about, you can mitigate a lot of that risk. Even enjoy buying watches, but learning about them is part of the fun too.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverin and this is Hodinkee Radio. This week we're dedicating the entire show to one conversation, and that's an interview between me and our own senior editor, Mr. John Buse. John's somebody I've known as long as I've been in the watch industry. As you'll hear, we met maybe my first or second week at Hodinkee, and he was on my first ever press junket with me. And our careers have kind of intertwined over the years at a few different places. So it was really fun for me to sit down with him and get some time to reminisce about some good old times and to hear about some things about his life and his career that I didn't know about, even after all of these years of working together. So we'll talk about watches, we'll talk about how the watch media space has changed over the years, we'll talk about his own collecting, but we'll also talk about the other things he's passionate about, like traveling to Japan and cooking at home. So I think you're really going to like this one. It gives you some insight into one of our core team members. I think you're going to learn some things you didn't know, and I'm going to let John do most of the talking here. So without further ado, let's do this. Hey dude, how's it going?
Going well, man. How are you?
Good. It's Friday afternoon, man. I'm ready for some weekend.
So am I, man.
You want to do some Friday beers? It's Friday afternoon. Why not?
I think that's a wonderful idea.
What are you drinking on your end? I know you're a big beer guy. What are you drinking?
Well, I have two choices, and I know you're a pretty big beer guy too, so I was hoping maybe you could help me out.
I think I can do that, yeah.
Okay, so I've got an Alien Church, which is kind of like the flagship New England style IPA from Tired Hands.
Okay.
And then I also have something called Addended Curricula, which is a dry hopped oak fermented saison from Tired Hands, but a little bit more in the, because it's oak fermented, it's a little sour, more in like the Hudson Valley type vein.
I'm going to vote saison every time, just in general, like purely on style. I'm going to go saison over IPA every time.
Cool. All right. So I'm going to crack that one. What do you got?
So I'm drinking, this super rare, like really weird, hard to find beer. I believe it's pronounced Miller Lite.
Okay.
I think is what it's called. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. I bought some cheap beer to keep in the fridge. That's nice and cold, easy to drink at the end of the day. So, since I got a couple more meetings after this one, I think I'm going to go with that. So I'll, for sound effect purposes, we'll put this right up next to the mic and, oh yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Nice.
Perfect.
Nothing wrong with a Miller Lite once in a while.
Not at all, man. I love a like really great sour. I love like a really big imperial stout, a great saison. But at the end of the day, like a cheap, for lack of a better word, like a cheap shitty lager is a good thing when it's 90 degrees out. But all right, cheers. Let's do this thing, man.
Cheers.
I'm really excited that we have you here to do this. We've been working through these editor interviews over the last, I guess, like 2 years plus now, or 2 years-ish. I've been looking forward to doing yours mostly because I have not had a career in the watch world without knowing you. I think I met you like my second or third day at Hodinkee at some event, some like watch cocktail thing. And then our careers have kind of like intertwined in a lot of ways over the last number of years. So I think this will be a fun way to look back for both of us. And, I'm excited to hear some stuff about your story that I'm sure I don't know. And then we'll talk about some of your other interests, too, outside of watches. I want to talk about beer. I want to talk about food. I want to talk about travel. So we'll get around to all that stuff. That sound good?
That sounds amazing, dude. Can't wait.
Awesome. So to start off, like, tell us who John Buse is. Like, where do you come from? How did you, like, pre-watch world, like, what was John Buse's life like pre-watches?
Oh, you know, so I mean, growing up, I was just a kid growing up in suburban Connecticut. I lived there my entire life. Big activities that I kind of that I remember from childhood were like soccer and swimming. Those are like, you know, and swimming in particular, which was a constant that went right up through almost through college. I almost swam in college, but I ended up not. Yeah, I mean, I've just always been kind of someone who enjoyed sports. You know, I always liked school growing up and enjoyed writing. That was kind of like a hobby of mine.
Did you go to school for journalism?
I didn't. I was an English major, a literature major.
Classic.
But yeah, but words and in reading and writing were always just kinds of like hobbies that I always found myself doing, you know, at swim meets when I wasn't actively competing. So yeah, I mean, I was just, that's kind of how I would describe myself. I'm not someone who tends to talk a lot about himself, but as you can probably tell.
But buckle up, that's what we're doing all show here. But so you went to college to be an English major. You were in Philly, right?
That's correct. Yeah. So I got like a scholarship to a little Jesuit college in Philadelphia. I had gone to like a Jesuit high school in Connecticut. And so it was okay. Kind of like a natural progression into a kind of a feeder college called St. Joseph's University. And I was there for all 4 years and decided to become an English major pretty early on in my time there.
Cool. And then you finished up and you moved back to Connecticut, and that's where this whole Watch World thing sort of took off, right?
Yeah, exactly. So like as I was, you know, finishing up school, I was, you know, kind of thinking, what do I want to do? I'm not totally sure. It's kind of like, you know, I think it's kind of a classic question for an English major, like what do I do with this degree?
Been there, done that.
Exactly, right? And so I thought, you know, journalism and specifically magazines seemed like it could be an interesting and possibly quite fun way to find my, you know, find my way into the working world. And yeah, so I just kind of set to work looking for entry-level jobs at like print publications. And I looked at, you know, places in New York, but I also kind of tried to figure out were there titles that might be interesting in Connecticut where I could find a job. And so I happened upon a magazine called International Watch Magazine, which still exists.
Good old IW.
Yeah. And so, you know, at the young age of 23, I submitted an application to IW. I submitted it was a very analog way to approach getting a job back then. I typed out a letter and attached my resume and said that I thought I could be a good copy editor if they needed one.
And this was when?
This was like 2005. And to my surprise, I heard back almost immediately. And before I knew it, I was in an interview. I think I wore my ESQ watch to the interview. And I remember the interviewer commented on it and said, oh, nice watch. But I knew very little. I would say actually I knew nothing about watches heading into it.
Yeah.
I remember when I... like when I was in high school and college, maybe not college, but when I was in high school for sure, I thought, for example, that like a Rolex was the only watch with a sweep secondhand. I thought that was like how you could identify a Rolex. But then I just learned everything about the industry, the brands, who the important players were, the important titles covering the industry. I learned everything, you know, I would say within the first year or so of being there.
Being a copy editor is a really good thing in that way. Like, you know, I was a copy editor very briefly at the beginning of my career, and like in a lot of ways that job like kind of sucks and is really thankless. Like you do really hard work and like your name isn't on the stuff that you're working on, and it's like it's often lots of rounds of like revisions and the same thing, and if mistakes make it through it's on you. Like, but the really valuable part of that job is that you get to read a lot and you get to kind of like look under the hood. And so like, do you remember early in those days, whether it was like any articles that made a really big impact on you or any writers who are now our colleagues that you sort of like discovered through that early day that you remember like being really impactful?
Oh, 100%. There was a gentleman who's no longer with us named Chuck Maddox, who was kind of like a larger than life personality especially in like vintage, Omega. So he was kind of like, I think, you know, in America anyway, like the expert on Speedmasters for a long time. Okay. And so occasionally he would contribute these like very long. I can remember one article that just took me forever to get. It was just so long. It had so much information in it. And I remember, you know, reading. That's where I learned everything about vintage Speedmasters, actually, was by copy editing one of his stories. I'm just thinking who else. Certainly, I mean, gosh, how could I forget Jack? I mean, Jack Forster used to occasionally have articles in IW. And I just couldn't believe. I was like, this guy is an incredible writer. I remember thinking when I would read his stuff. And I remember when I finally met him in person, I just went right up to him and I said, my gosh, I've edited your stories. Yet I never actually conversed. But I said, you know, I've copy edited your stuff and gosh, you're a fantastic writer. So the first thing I said to Jack was that compliment.
I'm going to guess that Jack liked that.
Yeah, he did. He did. Yeah.
That's a good first impression to make with Jack.
Yeah. And then of course, Elizabeth Dorr, who's a very well-known writer in the space. My bosses, Mike Thompson and Gary Gervinus, who are actually at IW to this day. So many, I don't want to leave people out. I mean, Roberta Noss, of course, I would edit her stories. Just a great many people who are still around today.
Nice. And we'll talk about, like, obviously your role progressed at IW and you pretty quickly in a couple of years ended up becoming the managing editor, which is what you were doing when I met you. But before we get into that, I want to ask, I mean, this is, I think, a really common question in the watch world, something like those of us in the industry, something we talk about all the time, which is like, what was it like for you coming from somebody who didn't really know anything about the industry to then going to Baselworld for the first time? Like, what was that experience like for you?
I mean, Baselworld blew my mind, and but I had already had my mind blown by the watch industry even before it. But just to talk about Baselworld first, I mean, and it's you know, it's too bad that it will not exist, certainly in its the incarnations that we knew it moving forward. And I'd imagine I'd like to actually hear what you thought about your first time at Basel too. But walking through that main row, which I remember Gary, my old boss, Gary Gervinus, used to call like the Savile Row of watchmakers, you know?
Yeah.
And just seeing these structures that were in some cases like five stories high, and then learning that they were put up for like less than 2 weeks and then taken right back down afterward to make way for the next show. I just couldn't believe that so many people cared so much about watches. It was really eye-opening, I would say. And then, of course, there really has never been another event like it for the watch business, and where quite literally everybody who was anybody in watches would go there, and so you would get to meet everyone.
Yeah,
whether it's like amazing independent watchmakers whose names certainly precede them, like Philippe Dufour, to see Mark Hayek just walking past you on the way to his next appointment. Or Terry Stern. It was really, you know, these were names that I knew, but it was kind of shocking to see these people just kind of in their element during their big week.
Yeah, I think I had a pretty similar experience. So I had been at Hodinkee, I guess maybe like 9 months by the time my first Basel rolled around, because I started about this time of year actually in the summer. And yeah, I think similarly to you, like I didn't quite understand the scale of the industry until I walked into Basel. And like by that point, I'd been to half a dozen press junkets. I'd flown to various corners of the world with watch brands. I'd been to manufacturers. But like you said, like until you see Rolex across from Patek and then their Chopard and Tudor and Omega at that point, and like you don't really get a sense for it until it's like, you're stewing in it for days. And for the booths, I remember one that I will never forget was like on the third floor of Longines booth that year. They had marble floors and a fountain, like a bubbling, like gushing, like water feature. And I was like, what the hell is this? Like this, like you said, this structure is up for 2 weeks and there's like marble floors and a fountain. Like what is going on here? You know? And I think that for me was the first taste of like the weirdness in some ways of the watch world, which I don't know about you. I have found like has not really slowed down or stopped at all. It's maybe changed a little bit, but like the watch world has its own sort of like peculiarities that you only learn by being in them. They're like kind of impossible to explain to people.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think certainly the trade shows have managed to maintain that kind of air, I would say. Some of the junkets, I think, are a little bit less. They're a little bit more tame now than they might have been. And when I say tame, I mean like kind of extravagant. Extravagant than they might have been in the past, and that's probably because of the impact of social media on kind of our world. I mean, it's you know, my first kind of wow moment. You know, covering launches and traveling to do this job came fairly early on. I would say maybe after about 4 months, 3 or 4 months of working as a copy editor, my boss came over to me, and I guess someone who was supposed to go to England that day was feeling ill and was unable to make it. We needed kind of a last minute change. And I was like driving to Newark Airport, boarding a plane, and then driving Aston Martins in England the next day. It was
not a bad way to make a living.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and so I had these kinds of experiences early on, and I mean, the work I found quite interesting, but the experiences that just seemed to come my way were like, none of my friends who were 23 years old were having any kind, like they were chained to their desk kind of doing whatever it was they were doing, whether they're manipulating Excel documents or maybe editing other titles. But I by far had the most fun job, I would say.
Yeah, I think, you know, I give my dad a hard time all the time. I think he still isn't entirely convinced that what I do is a job, you know? Like, he's an engineer. He's, like, at his desk or in, like, a clean room, like, helping make semiconductors all day. And I think when I tell him, like, oh, yeah, I have, like, a 2-week-long 3-city business trip to go on, he's like, are you sure that's not vacation? Like, are you entirely sure? But, yeah, it's not bad work if you can get it, right?
No, it's fantastic work if you can get it, I think.
Speaking of traveling, you know, I alluded to this earlier, but, you know, my first press junket, my first press trip came really quickly after I started at Hodinkee. Like, I think less than a month after I started, it might've been like my third or fourth week. And it was a trip to San Francisco with Tag Heuer in 2012 for the America's Cup. Tag was the big team sponsor, and they took mostly like sailing press and lifestyle press. And there were two watch journalists on the trip. It was me and you. And we had met, like I said, a couple of times by then. And that was like my first real taste of this. Do you remember that trip, I assume?
Oh, I 100% remember it. Yeah, of course. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And that was
a lot of fun.
I think that's a great first press trip too, to be honest.
Yeah, I think so too. It was definitely heavier on the socializing than on the like research portion, but that was my first experience of like asking a CEO if he would like take his watch off at dinner so I could like, you know, take it over into some natural light and shoot it for a blog post. And like, I was like very serious about like making sure I got like a good story out of this so I could, you know, come back and show Ben and say like, look, we got something nobody else got. And yeah, I remember it just being, it was my first chance meeting some other folks in the industry. You know, there were some folks local on the West Coast who were invited, and I think she didn't come on the whole trip, but I think Roberta maybe was there for part of it, for like one day, for like a dinner or something. But yeah, it's funny how you start to get a taste of this industry as like a real community too, right? And like, there's so many people who, you know, the CEO of Tag at the time was Jean-Christophe Babin, who now runs Bulgari, and like, you know, I had lunch with him a couple months ago, and it's like you sort of like, these relationships tend to last a long time. Like, very few people enter the watch world and then like turn over in 2 or 3 years, right?
That's a really good point. It is that kind of industry where people might move within it, but they tend to stay in the industry for quite a bit of time. I would agree with that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, for your career, right? So like, you're at IW, you were there for what, like 6 or 7 years?
Something like that. Yeah. I think it was like, 2005 to 2012. Yeah.
Okay. And then you moved over to a pair of magazines, Wristwatch and About Time, where you were the editor in chief, right?
Yeah. Of Wristwatch. So basically, you know, my friend and mentor, Gary Grudvinus, who actually had founded IW years and years before, left and had, eventually he had started up another magazine called Wristwatch, which was like focused on high-end mechanical stuff. And then he also started a second title called About Time, and that was much more focused on like fashion watches and just affordably priced quartz watches. And the idea was to target like a younger demographic with it. And so I just basically helped him getting those going. And that was a good lot of fun to kind of reconnect with him and to do that for a few years. We were both working from home. It was a very kind of a smaller operation than IW had been at the time. But it was a ton of fun to reconnect with him and start something new.
Cool. Yeah, I remember when you made that move over. I remember seeing you at Baselworld the first year you were at Wristwatch, and it was like the first day or two, maybe. It was early on in the show, and I remember being like standard Baselworld chit chat, like, oh, when's your next appointment? Oh, do you have any breaks today? Oh, are you gonna be able to get lunch? Like all this like standard like BS, right? And I remember you just being like, oh no, like I have 9 million appointments. They are all back to back. I'm running here, I'm running there. Like I remember you seeming kind of like, well, let's do this,
Was
it a big change going from, I mean, IW is not like a massive operation. It's not, 300 people, but like, was it a big change going to like a really bootstrappy, like startup-y kind of place?
I would say it was a pretty big change. The working from home thing was a new thing for me, certainly.
Okay.
It was just really two guys taking all the appointments they could in Basel, Whereas at IW, we had several editors on staff who were able to kind of spread things around. So it was a different experience, I would say. Yeah.
Okay. And then from there, you moved to Watch Journal, which was the first time you and I actually worked together. For people who may not know, Watch Journal is a part of Surface Media, which at the time also owned Surface Magazine, now also owns Surface Magazine and W Magazine and a few other little businesses. But Watch Journal was the watch pub, and I was at Surface, and you came on board as the editor-in-chief of Watch Journal. And I wonder if, taking a trip down joint memory lane here, what made you want to jump over to Watch Journal? Like what about that was an exciting opportunity for you at the time?
I think, primarily it was a few things. It was a chance to kind of take the reins of a title and really make it my own. I was able to kind of step in and really do whatever I wanted to with it. It was my title as the editor in chief. So that was a lot of fun. And then also it's just this, the fact that it was part of Surface, and Surface was doing such cool stuff at the time. I was like a fan of the magazine Surface. I would read that magazine often. I remember that was like one of the titles when I was at Basel or SIHH, I would always try to grab like the free copy. There were a few titles that I would always try to grab. But I would pick it up in New York as well. That was a lot of fun. I wasn't there for a terribly long period of time, but I still keep in touch with several of the people from there. Some of them we've even worked with on other projects. One of them at other projects at Hodinkee, Spencer Bailey, former editor in chief of Surface, has written for Hodinkee Magazine. Yep. So like really, there were some really tremendous people at that company. A lot of really smart people.
Yeah, I agree. I think, for me, one of the reasons I was at Bloomberg and went over to Surface, and I think I had a pretty similar experience where like there was a lot of opportunity and a lot of chance to like shape things. And I wonder how you found that experience of taking an existing publication and like obviously having to keep some stuff about it consistent, but really being able to put your stamp on it, and in an area where like by that point you'd been working on watches over a decade, like you were a real like veteran of this industry. How did you think about trying to do something different or new or that would like make a contribution to like add something to the dialogue instead of just being, another voice saying the same things?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. One of the things I realized pretty early on when I stepped in was that there were all these resources at Surface that I was able to kind of use for Watch Journal. And so like, you know, like the travel editorial section, I was able to kind of expand that and make city guides, I think, much bigger. What we were able to do with photo shoots, just kind of like some of the photographers we worked with, like Jens Mortensen, and then others were like really fantastic. So I would say it was just kind of like being able to leverage what Surface had to offer was a real advantage that Watch Journal had that no other print titles at the time in covering the watch space had, certainly in the United States. And so that was a lot of fun to be able to see where I could like fit things in and where I could find, an editor who might have a little bit of extra bandwidth who is like super talented and try to get them to do something for Watch Journal.
Yeah, I think one of the things I really liked, you know, about what you did with Watch Journal was making it a watch magazine that people who weren't into watches or people who weren't like fully obsessed with watches could still enjoy and could still find interesting content in. But while at the same time, like the watch people might kind of expand their horizons a little bit, it seemed to straddle that line in a nice way and in a way that felt organic and like really made sense. Whereas I think sometimes that can feel forced or a little weird.
Oh, thanks very much. That was definitely part of the idea. It was a lot of fun to do it.
We also both worked with someone there who is also now on the Hodinkee team, and I want to make sure we give him a shout out. So can you tell us who that was, how you met him, and how he became a part of the Hodinkee family?
Yeah, a really, really incredible guy, Logan Baker, who is now the shop editor. So he works, closely with everybody at Hodinkee. He produces, all of the wonderful content around the Hodinkee shop and yeah. Edits it or writes it. He was my intern when I started at Watch Journal, and he so quickly kind of just showed that he knew exactly what he was doing. I couldn't believe how young he was actually when he told me.
Yeah,
he was like. He was right out of college, and I was like sending him on press trips and really trusting him to handle interacting with brands and taking on like big stories that actually had to be I wasn't just saying write this up like a quick post on a new watch. I asked him to handle some big stuff early on, and he showed that he was one of the most capable young editors that I've ever come across, really.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I feel the same way. I feel like Logan, when I first got there, Logan was interning at Watch Journal before you were there. And I just remember thinking like, this kid's still in school? Like, A, how is he putting so many hours in with us? Like he seemed to like always be there. And like anytime you needed him, he was like right where you needed him, which was awesome. And then like you said, like the ability to kind of just like pick up and go. So I think, again, from the semi outside, like it seems like he was a really good asset for you to have there in terms of being able to like shape this thing, but also have somebody you could rely on to like kind of be your right hand and your eyes and ears out in the field.
Absolutely. And he's also, I would say he's an incredibly humble guy. And I think he, mm-hmm. he knew that taking on covering an industry such as this one would require a lot of learning. And he would read books to research stories, which, for someone who's, not even 22 years old, that level of commitment to producing great stories really impressed me. While completing a degree in journalism at NYU.
Yeah, that's wild. You had these two experiences as editor-in-chief, and for people outside the journalism world, I think there's often a misconception that like being the editor-in-chief of something means like you sit in your cushy corner office in some like giant skyscraper where you have like, a couch. And so it's like a Devil Wears Prada situation. You've got like three assistants like hanging up your coat and bringing you Starbucks and stuff. And you just say like, yes, no, yes, no. For anyone listening who doesn't know, like that is not what you do. Like even if you're the editor in chief of like Vogue or GQ or whatever, like that is not what you're doing. But how did you find being an editor in chief as like a job? Like what were some of the like the most rewarding parts, the most challenging parts? Was it something you enjoyed?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I enjoyed a lot. It's, I'd say probably the most rewarding part was like, sitting down and looking at a blank slate for an issue and trying to decide, how articles could fit together. One of the big mistakes that I think you can make when making a magazine is not to have things kind of like cooking all along. So it's often the case of kind of like, you know, picking from pitches that have come to you already that might already be stories that might already be in progress, and just seeing where they might fit in to an issue as it comes together, knowing when it's time to kind of hold off on something because it might make more sense to use in an issue down the road because of other content that will be kind of like coming together around that time. So it's a lot of planning, and it's like making anything that's composed of many parts. It's a balancing act and requires planning. And also it requires, you know, working with other people. It's not the kind of, I don't know of many editors in chief who would say that they sit down and plan out a whole issue by themselves. That's just not how it works. And I don't think that's how you make a great title or a great issue of a magazine that many people will love. I think you kind of have to have people who will push back on you and say like, that's not a good idea, you know, or people who will bring to you like ideas that you couldn't possibly have come up with on your own. Being an editor in chief is being able to produce something that many people contribute to, even if it's a smaller magazine with a small staff.
That's a really good way to describe it. Like, you're still doing the producing, but you're doing it with the help of a lot of people, and you have to like be able to find the right people. You need to be able to manage all of that talent, and then sort of like put a vision on it, like package it all in a way that people can digest it. Because I think people don't I think sometimes like you'll see a magazine and it has like 10 great stories in it, but they feel like they belong in 10 different magazines. And like, that doesn't work. Like, you don't want to subscribe to that. You don't want, like, it feels random. It feels weird. Whereas like, even if you pick up a magazine and only like 80% of it is great for you, if that 80% feels like it's like one cohesive unit and one cohesive vision, I think people connect with that a lot more. I think people really, it resonates with people.
You're 100% right. Yeah. I mean, there's got to be a reason why the pages, you know, go between the same two covers, you know? And then one other thing I would add too is that, like, you know, when you're running a title, you want people writing for you who are like super knowledgeable and passionate about a certain thing, but you also need to be able to kind of guide them and make sure that as they express their passion for a story as they're producing it, that they do it in a way that makes sense for your title.
And I think that brings us to kind of like the current chapter, which is your time at Hodinkee. You know, we had conversations, you know, back in 2017, and, you know, I know you and Ben had some conversations, and we were able to bring you on board and make you a member of the team. And, you know, your role has kind of shifted a little bit over the years. I mean, your title is the same. You are a senior editor, you know, but you've been able to work on a bunch of different projects, which I think is not uncommon for those of us at Hodinkee. We all kind of end up doing a little bit of everything, but you know, you've led feature stories on the web, things like Reference Points and like, you know, Week on the Wrists and Talking Watches, like big feature content. You know, you've done stuff like manage the magazine, you know, for quite a few volumes. You know, you've done things like even like news coverage when we've needed it, like fast breaking, whether it's industry news or new releases, like, you know, you come on Hodinkee Radio regularly, like you're kind of touching all parts of this. And previously your career had focused pretty heavily on print. I wonder what it was like for you coming to a place where like, yes, print was part of it, but like twice a year in a really sort of like deep considered way, but like your day-to-day job for most of the year was like not about a print magazine. Was that a big change for you? What did you think about that change? All of that?
Yeah, no, that definitely was. I loved it. It felt, and I continue to love it. It felt like totally new because it was new. Mm. I had never written, you know, so frequently for the web, and for such an audience too. I think an important thing that I'd like to say is that I, you know, I have a tremendous respect for like the Hodinkee community and for the readers. They are, I think, and it's because there is a community that I can say this and I think I can say I pretty confidently know it. They are like the most knowledgeable, you know, readership of a watch title out there, I think. And so, you know, producing on a regular basis, like very high quality content that would be read and appreciated by that readership was, you know, was and continues to be like a great challenge that I strive to meet every day, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I think in a funny way, like our audience does more sometimes even than like our colleagues to kind of like give you that kick in the ass to like do your best work. Because if you don't, you will get called out for it publicly on the article that has your name on it and on Instagram and on Twitter. Like if you screw up, you will get dragged. And I think that's actually a good thing. Like I find that feedback really helpful as a journalist. It forces me not to get lazy. It forces me to think ahead. It forces me, like, you know, even if I'm doing something like covering an auction where we're literally trying to be like up to the second as quickly as we possibly can get that information out there, like it always forces you to pause for a second and be like, did I consider everything here? Did I do this right? Is there a question I'm not asking? Because if you don't, like somebody in the comments will immediately. And I think that's a fun thing.
It is a fun thing. And it's, I would say it's a testament to like, you know, what Ben and what you were there very early too. Built was, I mean, it was, Hodinkee was certainly, I would say probably the most widely read or one of the most widely read you know, publications about watches long before I got there. And, you know, the ability of that we have to reach so many readers is something that I don't think any of us takes for granted, you know?
Yeah.
It's something that a lot of work went into building, and that it's all of our jobs to uphold. And I think it's something that we can all be proud of.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I wonder what is some work you've done at Hodinkee that you're most proud of?
Well, certainly on the web side, I'm proud of had the most fun interviewing Mario Andretti. Like that's something that for Talking Watches.
You guys just like hung out in his basement, right?
It was incredible. Yeah, it was.
That's wild.
I think, yeah, it was the video team. I think Ben came along for that one because, you know, Mario Andretti is someone
course,
that everyone.
Yeah.
Certainly for someone who loves cars as much as he does, I think it's someone you just have to meet. And Mario Andretti could not have been a kinder person. He showed us around his whole home, really welcomed us with open arms, had the most fantastic stories to tell about his watches. And, you know, for me, he's up there with some of the all-time great Talking Watches guests. And I hope
I did an okay
job hosting, but I think...
You did an awesome job. I think it's an all-time episode, personally.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
So, was that your first one, hosting?
No. My first one was Praz, who brought...
Oh, yeah.
Who brought some real heat in terms of the watches.
He did.
Yeah, he had some serious Pateks and other watches with him. He was the first one. Then Andretti, also Greg Norman was a fantastic person to meet. I mean, I was kind of a racing fan growing up, but really, like my memories of watching Greg Norman playing golf on Sunday afternoons growing up are, I mean, it's like I remember them vividly. You know, he at one time was. Just like he was the biggest name in golf during a period in the 90s, I think. And to sit across from him with, a dozen watches between us and hear him just kind of recount his memories playing golf. You know, he was one of the first golfers to wear a watch when he played. Mm. And to hear him just kind of talk about, I had no idea that watches had played such a large role in his life in that. And who could have possibly thought that watches would lead to my having a chance to not only meet him, but also interview him.
And again, like, you know, with him and Andretti, I think it's worth emphasizing again, like in his home, like people, you know, what people see on the site is a, you know, 10 to 15 minute video. What they don't always notice or know is that that's the product usually of spending anywhere between 4 and 8 hours with someone. And, you know, the interview itself might be 35, 45 minutes, maybe an hour for some of the longer ones. I think Ben and John Mayer talked for almost 2 hours for his second episode, which I got to see live, which was wild. But, you know, there's something really interesting about, like, you show up at Mario Andretti's house, and he gives you the tour, and then Will and Gray and Dave and Shahed like set up the cameras and everything's good, and you know, like while all this is happening, like you're largely as the host, like you're managing Mario, like you're like chatting with him, you're hanging out in his house, you've got to like keep him ready, you got to make sure the good stories are saved for on tape. It's like a really intimate interaction with somebody, and it's a really special thing, and it's cool then to get to see on camera like all of that rapport come out. And I think the Andretti one is a great example of that, where like it's clear to me watching it that you guys had had some good conversations before the tape started rolling, and like he's comfortable, you're comfortable, you can kind of like get past all that weirdness first.
Yeah, absolutely. And also he was just such like a warm, nice guy that I kind of knew. I was a little bit nervous going into it. Just, you know, to the biggest kind of filmed interview I had ever done to that point. He totally made me feel comfortable too, you know, as much as it was my job
to
make him feel comfortable, he did the same. And it came out pretty well, I think. What I would also say, you know, doing reference points in the GMT was another digital feature that I was super proud of. It was reference points. I had authored some reference point stories for the magazine, but I had never produced kind of the major digital reference points that is, I think, really benchmark Hodinkee content.
Yeah.
And so it was just this year that I had a chance to take on the GMT. You had just done the Submariner, and I think your article that had come out the year before really set the bar for what a reference points could be.
Sorry about that one.
You set an incredibly high bar, but I have no problem telling you, you laid out a very clear blueprint with that story for what one
That's
could
good
do.
Here.
And so to be able to like, you know, add the interview section at the end and really just make sure that everything about the article was perfect was a challenge, and it was a lot of fun to do.
I think it turned out great. I think it's real like benchmark content. It like, to me, those are the kind of stories that remind me of like early Hodinkee. Like we've definitely evolved as a business, and I think our sort of like special sauce has stayed the same, and the personality has largely stayed the same despite the fact that, you know, we're not two people writing or three people working on it, but you know, 50 something people now. But like those are the stories where like not only the tone and the approach, but like the execution and the way it's framed and like all the little things just like feel like that's when we're like firing on all cylinders and like doing the best things we can do.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think, you know, especially when it comes to kind of the storytelling around vintage watches, you know, I think to me that's certainly when I was working at like print titles outside of Hodinkee, that was what I looked to you guys for, was this real making something that even to someone like me who had worked, you know, in the watch industry for as long as I had, helping me kind of understand and synthesize what mattered in terms of like, you know, important vintage watches was a real benchmark of Hodinkee, and something that I didn't think I would ever get to do for a long time. And then I came here, and now it's something that I get to do.
All day, every day, my friend. Before we get into your own personal sort of like watch journey outside of your career, or I guess it's part of your career, but
I'm sorry, I don't mean to. One other thing I just wanted to say on the reference
for sure,
points
dude.
Thing is there's these kinds of projects definitely do not come together with just one person. So I'd like to thank Eric Wind for all of his help on the reference points with the GMT. And then also the video team who shot it, and in particular Dave, who did the edit on that and absolutely killed it. I mean, that you know, the video was fantastic. So hats off to him, or to both of them.
For sure, the video team is largely responsible for me not looking like a total idiot all the time. So I thank them every opportunity I can get. That's a good move. So the last thing kind of work related that I wanted to ask you is Do you have any favorite non-story memories from Hodinkee? Like, or not even just from Hodinkee, but from your career in watches? Like, any moments that stand out to you that weren't a story you wrote or a meeting you were at, but just, like, something that happened, someone you met, like, some goofy shit that happened at the office, like, whatever. Like, any moments that stand out to you where you were like, this could only happen here?
I wouldn't say goofy necessarily, but like in those first few Baselworld shows, kind of going from what felt like an extremely like buttoned up experience of like putting on a suit and kind of like struggling not to sweat through it all day as I went from appointment to appointment, to then going out and having like, you know, kind of just like really like fun evenings where everyone would like relax, you know, in Basel, and seeing how. This was like a business where people, like took things very seriously. It's like a very, very Swiss experience to go to Baselworld, but everyone kind of understood that, like, at the end of the day, like, you know, we are trying to have fun too. And, so I would say just kind of like, just experiencing like good times with people with whom I'd worked hard, I'd say.
Yeah. Are there any ways in which you think the watch world as a whole has changed over the last, I guess, like 15 years, you know, any huge changes that stand out to you?
Well, I mean, it's certainly kind of like the rise of like digital platforms, which it's not even really a new thing anymore, but for a long time it was a handful of print titles who kind of ruled the day. And I think, around 2008, 2009, when Hodinkee came on board and when some other titles started coming, you started to see that like the whole news cycle just became much, much faster around writing about watches. I can remember, Stephen, like, you know, my first couple of press trips that I took, you would go and you would see a watch, and it might be a huge trip with like a, 30 or 40 journalists, and they would show you something brand new, but there was like a very strict embargo and you wouldn't publish a story about it until maybe two months later. Okay. So just the way that stories are covered is totally different now. To go somewhere to take photographs and to have a story up before you go to dinner is something that's probably one of the biggest changes that I could say I've witnessed in my time doing this.
Nice. And I want to talk a little bit about your own watch collecting, because, you know, similarly, like, I also came to watches with like a passing interest, but like I didn't really know anything. And now I think, you know, you did the same thing, and like we are both now like deep into it. I wonder if you can just share a little bit about like, at what point did you, you know, first buy a watch where you were like, I can't believe I'm spending this much money on a watch. And then how has your collection kind of in your own taste evolved since?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the first mechanical watch I ever got was actually a Vostok. It was like a Russian kind of automatic watch. And it was, I wanted something that was like very affordable that I thought would be relatively durable, that I wouldn't care about too much if I scuffed it up. And so I got a Vostok watch, and I don't have it anymore. I gave it to my brother a while ago. I wonder if he still has it. But the first time I ever spent like, you know, serious money, you know, for me on a watch was probably an Oris diver that I bought like years and years ago. And that, it cost, you know, more than $1,000, which to me was a big deal, you know?
Yeah, of course.
There have been maybe bigger watches since then, but that's the first time that I remember thinking like, oh, this is like a serious, you know, quality Swiss made watch. How has my taste changed? I guess I've kind of, oh, and then another watch that I would add to that too would be actually one that I think you and Ben helped me find, which was an IWC Caliber 89.
I remember that watch well.
Yeah, I remember thinking like, you know what, I have some watches, but I don't have like a serious kind of dress watch, a gentleman's a hand-wound gold dress watch. And so, that one for me too. That was like, you know, close to $3,000 I spent on it. And that was, I was like, oof, that kind of costs a lot. But it felt like, you know, I had a sense that it was a watch that I would own for a long time. And it's been about 8 years and I still have it. So it was a good pickup, I think.
Yeah, that's awesome. I remember when, you know, we were in the two-person WeWork. It wasn't even the three-person WeWork, which means Will wasn't even working full-time for us yet. But I remember you came in with the watch and you were like, A, did I buy a good thing? And B, what strap do I put on this? And, you know, I at the time knew nothing. So I remember just sitting there and watching Ben kind of like pour over the watch and, you know, tell you everything was good and this is how you could tell and here's the strap to pair it with. And I remember just being like, I have a lot to learn here. Like, holy shit, you know? But yeah, it's cool that you still have that watch. And I think it's interesting too, because it's kind of an outlier in your collection. Like, I think your collection, and correct me if you think I'm mischaracterizing it, but like, it tends towards sort of like classic sport watches.
I would say.
I agree, yeah.
Yeah, it's like very functional, like GMTs, you know, Pilot's chronographs, like really functional but classic, like nothing too over the top or crazy. But then to have this like little gold fancy lug dress watch is kind of like a cool counterpoint to something like a modern Rolex GMT.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's still a watch that if I'm wearing a suit, there's like a good chance I'll wear it. I have two kind of dressy watches, and one of them is a GMT. It's a Grand Seiko GMT. But it's whenever I'm like suiting up, it's one of those two watches that tends to get the call. If I know that I'll be traveling to a watch show or something like that, then the GMT will probably get the call, just because it's a, you know, travel watch, obviously. But the Calibre 89 is a watch that I have no plan of ever in the Grand Seiko, for that matter, too. Those are two watches that I hope are really with me for the very long haul.
Yeah, and the Grand Seiko brings us to another point, which I do want to touch on some non-watch stuff here at the end for just a couple minutes. But you are a big Japanophile, I would say, and the Grand Seiko kind of fits nicely with that, right?
It totally does. I mean, it's I've been to Japan, I guess, a few times, but the first time was actually with Grand Seiko, oddly, on a press trip that they did. And that was back when I was at IW. And being in Japan and meeting the folks from Grand Seiko definitely sparked a lot of curiosity in me about the brand, but it took me a while before I bought my first one. That wasn't until, 2017 or early 2018. But Japan is, it's one of those places, right, that I think people who have been there, they kind of, I think we have a lot of similar experiences from a culinary standpoint. Even it's really a remarkable place, you know. Mm. And then culturally, of course, with all of the temples and all of the kind of, you know, the heritage that really reaches back thousands of years. It's an incredibly old place, and it's an incredibly it is really a unique place. I would say also a very special place. And it's a place that my wife and I love to travel to, and you know, we try to. I have a feeling that it's the kind of place that we're going to try to go to every year or every other year, as we go forward. Because my wife actually grew up in Kyoto,
right?
And so when we go, it's like she gets to reconnect with her home a little bit, and it's kind of like a story that continues to reveal itself to me every time I go. And I come back with a little something more every time.
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, on the culinary side, I mean, even beyond Japan, I know you're a big food guy. We talked at the beginning of the show about your interest in beer, but you know, on Friday Live a couple weeks ago, you cooked some ramen for the audience. In addition to being an eater, you are also interested in cooking, right? Like, you don't just want to go to restaurants. You are interested in food and cooking, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I love learning new techniques and learning how to, you know, make the things that, I find delicious at home, you know, and it's been a useful, that, you know, kind of curiosity has been useful or proven useful, certainly during like, you know, the pandemic, of course. And so like knowing how to make like a cold noodle dish or, you know, ramen at home. I've even kind of messed with, You know, it's interesting with ramen, there are no rules. It's like the one, there may be others, but it's the one Japanese kind of type of cuisine that I know of where there are no established rules. You can really do whatever you want. And so I've done things like, for example, the day after St. Patrick's Day, turned my turned the water that I cooked my corned beef in into a broth, added some shoyu, and then made that into a ramen with cabbage and reserved corned beef brisket, you know. Cooking all kinds of food, not just Japanese food, but I would say especially Japanese food has been a lot of fun.
Great. Well, I've got some kind of quick fire questions that I want to ask you here at the end to wrap things up, because we're running out of time, sadly. But you know, some of these we'll start with some food related things, and then we'll dabble in a couple other things too. So I guess the first question, we'll stick with this theme of Japanese food for now. What is one dish that you think people may eat out that they should try making at home?
I would say, you know, I would think. Here's what I'll say: Hainanese chicken.
Hainanese chicken.
If you have, you can find recipes online for this, and I might be able to dig one up and share it somehow with readers. But if you,
we'll throw it in the show notes. If there's a link to it, we'll link it up.
Yeah, if you have a rice cooker, you can just with some simple spices, you can make something that you would that honestly, to me, rivals like plates of Hainanese chicken that I've had in Singapore. And it's so simple. You're literally steaming chicken thighs on top of rice in a rice cooker, and with a bit of chicken stock in with the water. And it's an amazing. It's one of my favorite things to eat in the world anyway. Hainanese chicken or chicken rice, as it's often called. But that's something that I never thought I could have possibly made at home. And it was actually my wife who found the recipe, and now it's something that we make like almost weekly. So I would say that. That's
awesome.
Chinese Singaporean dish.
Perfect. What is the restaurant meal you are most excited to go have when restaurants reopen?
I mean, like great sushi, right?
Yeah, dude.
Yeah, I mean, I think
I think you and I are probably having a similar problem right now, which is that the lack of quality sushi in quarantine is like kind of killing me.
You know what? You know where I kind of want to go actually is the place I went with you on the Upper East Side. I don't know if it's a secret that you're trying to keep for yourself or if you...
Yeah, we can name drop it. It's called Tanoshi. It's on York Avenue. Highly recommended. We should meet there when things open back up.
Yeah, yeah. Just to have that experience of like sitting at a counter close to other people, not feeling weird about it, right? And then to combine that with the food, and then also the place is like BYO, so you can kind of splurge on the sake, you know, that kind of a meal, I think I'm really looking forward to.
Sweet. Favorite brewery?
Oh, that's such a hard question. Okay. My true favorite brewery is this little tiny brewery that few people know called Troon, and it is in Hopewell Township, New Jersey. You can find that it's T-R-O-O-N, and you can find them on Instagram. They drop beers sporadically on Instagram, and you have to somehow, every time they drop one, I get the alert on Instagram, and then I'm like fumbling with my credit card trying to get it. And I've gotten lucky only a few times, because it sells out within minutes, and it's the best. They're the best like New England style IPAs I've ever had in my life from anywhere, truly. The good thing is they operate, they don't have a tap room, but they do. They're associated with a restaurant on the same property, which is a wonderful place called Brick Farm Tavern, also in Hopewell, New Jersey. And you can just go have their beers there on tap, and you can have wonderful kind of like farm to table food. So that's my favorite. Then also like Tired Hands, which I'm having right now, and Other Half also are really great breweries.
Awesome.
Also Hudson Valley Brewery.
Yeah, I'm a big Hudson Valley stan. I love those brews so much. Jeez. Yeah. Okay. So let's go back to watches. We'll finish up on a couple of watch related questions here. What's the watch in your collection that if you had to get rid of things, what would be the last thing to go?
The last one to go, my Grand Seiko GMT, SBGM 221. that's a special watch for me. It was the first watch I bought after I started at Hodinkee. It's the watch I wore when I got married. It's the watch that I think still probably most people who know me tend to think of, you know, as the watch on my wrist.
In the office, we refer to this watch as the Buse. Like, this is the Buse watch.
Yeah. You know, it's funny though. I think you either had written about it or had photographed it for something. And then Jack also had a very similar watch. So in a way you guys definitely influenced my decision, to buy that watch, it is a killer watch. I love it.
What's the next watch on your wish list?
You know, I mean, I haven't bought, I always considered myself a chronograph guy before I bought like two GMTs kind of back to back. I would actually love to, and it's not like some watch that you have to put yourself on a wait list for, and it's a watch that I feel like at this point in my life, I probably should have owned, but like a Speedmaster Professional probably.
Yeah, that's fair. It's a great watch. And what is your Holy Grail watch?
Holy Grail watch.
Price doesn't matter. If you could wake up every day and have any one watch on your wrist, what would it be?
Really, really nice 6542 on a nice bracelet with an original bezel that still looks good. You know, that's
like my Holy Grail. Of a watch.
It's funny too how doing reference points, you get sort of like Stockholm syndrome with the watches you're writing about. I was never a sub guy, and the moment I finished writing that, I was like, I think I need a big crown. Like, I think I need one. Which it's a little tough to just make that happen, but that's good answer. All right, last thing I'm going to ask you, and then I'll let you go. I know we both have other meetings to head off to, what is one piece of advice about watches? It can be about collecting, it can be about learning about watches, it can be whatever, but what is one bit of watch-related advice that you want to pass on to our listeners from your tenure in the watch industry?
I would say read a lot and try to make informed decisions. You know, if you're just starting out collecting, you will make some mistakes, but by educating yourself, by reading, you know, people who know what they're talking about, you can mitigate a lot of that risk. And so I would say, you know, don't rush into a watch purchase that you may end up regretting later. Even enjoy buying watches, but you know, learning about them is part of the fun too.
Well, this has been super fun. I've had a really good time, and not just because I got to drink a beer in the middle of the afternoon, but this was good. It's good. I mean, you know, I think a lot of people are experiencing this where with, you know, working from home, we don't get to see our coworkers as much. So it's nice to get like a solid hour, turn all the notifications off, chat, talk about some good old times, some stuff I didn't know about you. And thanks for coming on the show, man. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, man. This was a lot of fun.
Awesome. Thanks, man. Have a good weekend.
Yep, you too.